a little junior size one heifer session. We were here, my family and I, last year during the month of July, and I did Bonheffer for the whole month, and I figured that everybody had had Bonheffer up to the ears here, and so I decided that I'd try not to mention his name this summer. And Carol mentioned that there would be people who had an interest in Bonheffer and perhaps would like some little time with him and about him, and so asked if I would plug in a 3 o'clock thing. So that's what this is, and we have until 4 o'clock when there's another discussion here, as you know, and we can just see how it goes, if there's interest, if people would like to go on about him. We can certainly arrange subsequent 3 o'clock sessions, and there's a number of things we can do. I didn't bring any Bonheffer stuff, but I've got a little stuff in my head, and we can go on that for a little while at least. Today might be just a little smorgasbord. And I realize there's some of you who know a great deal about Bonheffer. There's some of you who maybe have barely heard his name. And so maybe I should just say, to begin with, that he was a German pastor, also theologian, who lived from 1906 until 1945. He became involved in the resistance movement during the Second World War and was imprisoned for about 18 months by the Nazis and was finally executed by the Nazis in 1945, shortly before the end of the war. He left behind him a legacy both of personal life and commitment, but also a remarkable literature that has been worked over by lots of people since he died. And he is now, I would say, one of the most exciting sources for the church's reflection on the faith, and is being talked about and written about a great deal. There are some books in the library here, and perhaps in this session today I could say something about some of the Bonheffer literature, and maybe something about the reception of Bonheffer by various people, and maybe a word about interpretation, maybe a few things about his life. I hope you'll feel free to raise questions as we go. And I'll certainly leave some time before 4 o'clock for some conversation. I apologize to you for drinking coffee while you have none. It's all right for you to fall asleep in a 3 o'clock afternoon session, but I really ought not to, I guess, if that can be helped. The literature is simply overwhelming. I have at home a bibliography that I've put together, which is 80 pages long with about 15 or 20 entries on every page. There is literally no end to the Bonheffer literature. I say that I didn't bring anything along, which I didn't, but I happen to have 3 Bonheffer books that I brought along, but that was not so that I could talk about Bonheffer. It just happens to be that I bring my work with me when I come here, and these are simply 3 1972 publications that I'm writing reviews for journals. André Dumas, French theologian, Dietrich Bonheffer, Theologian of Reality. It's a marvelous book, runs 300 pages, and it's published actually 1971, late 1971. Heinrich Ott, this thing runs well over 400 pages. Reality and Faith, the Theological Legacy of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Heinrich Ott, is successor to Karl Barth at the University of Basel. This is the first volume of a projected multi-volumed systematic theology. Volume one is The Legacy of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. That's the way he begins his systematic theology. That's an impressive volume. I guess I'm not going to say very much about it because I doubt that very many of you will be going after that, at least within the next few days. This is Larry Rasmussen, also 1972 publication, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Reality and Resistance. Rasmussen is a graduate of our school in St. Paul, has taught at St. Olaf College, is now going to Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., and he spent a year in Germany interviewing various people who were in the resistance movement about Bonhoeffer, and the big question which he faces here is how a man of faith thought through the tremendous ambiguities and complexities of involving himself in the resistance movement, even to the point of an attempt at assassination, on Hitler's life. That's a very nice volume. That's just illustrative of the kind of stuff that's rolling out constantly on Bonhoeffer. We ought to say something maybe about the books that are actually in this library, and maybe first of all something about the primary literature. I guess I'm going to say something about the reception of Bonhoeffer first, because it may be easier then to talk about some of the books. I mentioned that he died in 1945, executed by the Nazis. He was not very well known at the time. Certainly there were a good many people in Germany who knew about him, but he was not known very much outside of Germany. In 1945, he became a martyr of the church in Germany, and some of his stuff began to be republished and to come into translation. In the United States, the first book that came into translation was entitled The Cost of Discipleship. That is in this library. And the Bonhoeffer books are all on this wall on a little shelf, so you can find them very easily. This is an exposition of the Sermon on the Mount, which meant a great deal to Bonhoeffer. And it contains also a preliminary essay on grace. And Bonhoeffer talks in that essay about costly grace. And he says that a problem is that for Luther, grace was a tremendous relief that came to him after struggling like crazy for years and years and years to earn his salvation. And when the grace of God crashed through to him, it was a whole transformation of his existence, and as it turned out, a kind of a transformation of Western history. But that as second and third and fourth and fifth generation people started to talk about the grace of God, it got to be that grace became very cheap, Bonhoeffer says. So that people were always telling one another, you're forgiven, you're saved by grace alone, and that's the beginning and end of the story. So Bonhoeffer says, no, grace is not cheap. Grace is free, but it's not cheap. Grace is costly. And he says, as a Lutheran, he says, we Lutherans have gathered like eagles round the carcass of cheap grace, and there have drunk the poison which has killed the life of following Christ. So he sets off laying that costly grace thing on the reader, and then spins into a discussion of the Sermon on the Mount, that's the cost of discipleship. When that first came out, I can remember reading that in about 1948. That's the first thing I ever read by Bonhoeffer. I never heard of his name. I just picked up the book and read it, and that zapped me into a state that I'm not yet out of. And I think that happened to a lot of people. It is a kind of a literalistic interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount, and he really rings the changes on the don't resist evil thing. And so in those early days, Bonhoeffer was picked up by various peace churches, by the Quakers, Mennonites, who used him as a champion for their particular views on nonviolence. Later on, other of the Bonhoeffer books came into translation, and it wasn't so very long before his Ethics and a book entitled Letters and Papers from Prison came out. Letters and Papers from Prison is also in this library. It looks like this. That's in paper. Ethics looks like this. That's in paper. These two books came from the last part of his life. Ethics was written mostly prior to his imprisonment, and this is just a collection of stuff, letters and papers, as it says, that he wrote while he was in prison. And while there, he started to think about the Christian faith in some rather radical ways, and he coined a phrase entitled non-religious Christianity, or non-religious interpretation of biblical concepts. And when that came out in the United States in translation, a whole new group of people got excited about Bonhoeffer because they thought, here is a guy who out-liberals all the liberals. He takes Christianity and he takes the religion right out of it, and he makes of it what it really should have always been, namely a great plan for brotherly love and moral instruction. And so the people who picked up Bonhoeffer in the first place, who were essentially very conservative people from Cost of Discipleship, then abandoned Bonhoeffer, and he was picked up by all kinds of people whose big thing was to ethicize the faith or to turn Christianity into morality. Well, at the present time, the literature is pretty well translated and out, and there's been all kinds of work done on Bonhoeffer, and both of those groups have been seen to be, if not wrong, at least inadequate in their interpretation. Bonhoeffer was by no means a simple non-violence man. He committed himself to the execution of Adolf Hitler, and he was by no means a moralizer of the faith. His phrase non-religious Christianity does not mean doing away with God and the Bible and prayer and all of those things, but it means precisely putting those things back into Christianity, because religion for Bonhoeffer means man's quest for God and is a very anti-Christian kind of formula. So I would say that at the present time, the situation is beginning to get clear, and books like Ott and Duma and Rasmussen can no longer present oversimplified pictures of Bonhoeffer as some of that original literature did. So that's kind of the general pattern of the reception of Bonhoeffer in this country. In Europe, the situation has been quite different, and Dumas is a Frenchman. It would be possible to talk about the reception of Bonhoeffer by various European peoples, but let's just talk about Germany. And there are various strains of the reception of Bonhoeffer. For instance, political. In Western Germany, the resistors to the Nazi movement, among whom was Bonhoeffer, became after the war great heroes because they became a way in which Germany could say the Nazis were a small minority of us. The real Germany was the other Germany, the non-Nazi Germany, and the resistance movement was an example of what Germany truly was about. So that the Bonn government has published a big book entitled July 20th, 1944, which is the date of the unsuccessful attempt on Hitler's life. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer's picture is in that book. And if you write a nice enough letter and send it to the Bonn government and tell them you're interested, they'll send the book to you for free. They're very much interested in promoting the reality of the resistance movement during the Nazi years. The Bonn government has published a little section of 8 stamps, a memorial to the July 20th plotters on Hitler's life, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer is on one of those stamps. So that officially, the Bonn government honors Bonhoeffer and his compatriots. On the other hand, there is a popular notion about these people. We were in Berlin on July 20th, 1964, the 20th anniversary of the failure of the July 20th plot. And that week Der Spiegel, which is a kind of a German Time magazine, came out with a survey that it had done on the reaction to the resistors in West Germany. And the question was, do you consider Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his, they didn't put it that way, do you consider the July 20th plotters to be traitors or patriots? And some 86-87% of the people who responded on that poll said they were not patriots, but they were traitors to Germany. Now that doesn't mean at all that 87% of the people were Nazis, but it does mean that that percentage of people in West Germany consider assassination of the head of state to be too drastic a means to resist Nazism, okay? So that's kind of politically. One can also talk ecclesiastically. There are people in the church in West Germany who think of Bonhoeffer as a great martyr. And in the village church at Flossenbürg, he was executed at the concentration camp in Flossenbürg. There stands a plaque on the wall that says, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, witness for Jesus Christ among his brothers. And there was a huge argument about whether or not that plaque should go on the wall of the church. And the bishop in that area, Bavaria, said, absolutely not. He died as a political traitor, not as a Christian martyr. Another says, no, he died as a Christian martyr. So, big fight, finally, the plaque got on the wall. But there are a lot of people who are very unhappy about that. There are things all over West Germany named after Bonhoeffer. Youth houses and churches and hostels and camps and all kinds of things. And there's a little church in Berlin with 6 stained glass windows, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Francis of Assisi, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So there's on the one hand a very positive, on the other hand a very negative attitude toward Bonhoeffer. One can also talk theologically, and I should say that apart from Ott's book, and he's a Swiss, he's not a German, Bonhoeffer has not been picked up very much by theologians in West Germany. I'm not sure what the reason for that is. I think he's kind of an embarrassment to them. Most of the people doing theology in the last years at least were men who somehow or another managed to survive the Nazi years. I guess it would be wrong to try to kind of psychoanalyze that. The fact of the matter is that he's not been used very much to date by theologians in West Germany. In East Germany, the situation is very different. Politically, he is, without any question, a great hero. Bonhoeffer was used, as has been Che Guevara and Angela Davis, and anybody who's available, who has fought the system, fought the dirty capitalists, fought the dirty fascists. He has been used by them as a great victory fighter. And so virtually uniformly throughout East Germany, Bonhoeffer is used much more than in West Germany, and he's uniformly appreciated. So that the reception of Bonhoeffer is very ambiguous, it's very spotty. You can pick it up at different times and different places and read it very differently. It's by no means a uniform picture or a unidirectional picture. So that's, I want to say that thing about the reception. I'll say some things about some of the books. I've already mentioned Cost of Discipleship. There is, not in this library, but there is a very nice book. I happen to translate it for Augsburg Publishing House, entitled Psalms, the Prayer Book of the Bible. It's a tiny thing of about 55 pages, but he has some introductory statements about the Psalms, about how Jesus used them, about how the church can use them. And he groups them in different categories and talks a little bit about them. That's a nice, simple little book, but it's loaded with all kinds of undercurrents and important kinds of theological things. Life Together is a book that he wrote when he was training pastors for the Confessing Church, a kind of underground church during the Nazi years. He had them in a little place out in Pomerania called Finkenwalde. It was an illegal seminary. It was an unofficial seminary. They were constantly being harassed by the Gestapo. They lived together in a tiny little place. There were about 25 or 30 of them. And they shared together confession. They shared together the hymns. They shared together the reading of the scriptures. They went out into neighboring parishes and preached the word, and they had a fantastically close time together with one another, and Bonhoeffer wrote up that experience and put it into this book, Life Together. It's really nice. The first chapter is called Community. He talks, the last chapter is entitled Confession. There's stuff on the ministry of listening, life alone, life together, the day with others. He says that under confession, he says that too often people in the church have fellowship together as good people, but the breakthrough to fellowship in the church seldom occurs, because although they have fellowship together as good people, they don't have fellowship together as sinners. Bonhoeffer says, for goodness sakes, that which ties people in the church to one another is not that they're good people. There's a tragic misunderstanding of what the church is about, but that they are forgiven sinners, and until that fact is recognized and expressed, there can be no real fellowship in the church. When he talks about community, he says that it is a mistake for either the individual Christian or for the Church of Jesus Christ to be constantly taking its spiritual pulse. He says, we believe in the Holy Christian Church. It's an article of faith. It's a given. And he says that the church is not an ideal toward which we must strive, but it is a reality in which we are invited to participate. That makes all the difference in the world as to how one understands what life in the church is about. That's life together. It happens to be in hardback here. It's also in paperback. It's a very, very nice book. The Ethics is actually not a book in that Bonhoeffer never finished the job of writing it, but he made four stabs at it. He started four different times to write a book on ethics, and he thought that that would be the major work of his life. He died before he got it finished, and his good friend Eberhard Beke took those four attempts and slopped them together and edited them and said, that's The Ethics by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I think it's kind of tough reading. I think it's no place to begin. I think you should begin with a thing like The Psalms, or you should begin with Life Together, possibly Cost of Discipleship. The Ethics is kind of tough going until you have some idea what it is that he's talking about. Letters and Papers from Prison has been read by all kinds of people who don't know anything about Bonhoeffer, and you really don't have to know anything about Bonhoeffer. It says, Dear Carl, thanks a lot for the cigar you sent last Saturday. Lots of stuff like that. You know, that it isn't necessarily loaded with all kinds of theological stuff. There's poetry in here, there's a wedding sermon, all kinds of neat little stuff. But if you are alive to theological issues, and if you worry about what the Christian faith is about, then this thing is really enough to keep you going for a long, long time. And the talk about non-religious Christianity begins with the letter of May 30th, 1944. And that's some really mind-blowing stuff, and if you wish, we can talk about that sometime. I'm going to read you a little poem that's called Who Am I? He wrote it while he was in prison. It'll give you some flavor of the man. Who am I? They often tell me I step from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerily, firmly, like a squire from his country house. Who am I? They often tell me I talk to my warders freely and friendly and clearly, as though it were mine to command. Who am I? They also tell me I bear the days of misfortune equably, smilingly, proudly, like one accustomed to win. Am I really then really all that which other men tell of, or am I only what I know of myself, restless and longing and sick, like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath as though hands were compressing my throat, yearning for colors, for flowers, for the voices of birds, thirsting for words of kindness, for neighborliness, pausing in expectation of great events, powerlessly trembling for friends at an infinite distance, weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making, faint and ready to say farewell to it all. Who am I? This or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once? A hypocrite before others and before myself a contemptibly woe-begone weakling? Or is something within me still like a beaten army fleeing in disorder from victory already achieved? Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. Lots of great stuff. I think that that's a book that you can enjoy just kind of paging through and reading a little bit here and there. There are other things. There are four fat volumes of collected stuff, the Gesammelte Schriften in German, that's coming into translation. I think it's not necessary at this moment to say very much about that. There is a big, fat, marvelous thing by Eberhard Beke, and the title is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and there is a subtitle, Man of Vision, Man of Courage. Eberhard Beke was his very good friend. When Bonhoeffer died, he left everything, his piano and all of his stuff to vape you. He's a big teddy bear of a man who runs a continuation studies center in Rengsdorf, Germany. He's a man of about 65 years of age, a little younger than Bonhoeffer was. He spent his life putting together the Bonhoeffer legacy. He edited the letters and papers, he edited the ethics, and this is his magnum opus, his great work. It runs about 800 pages in English. It was over 1,000 in German. He had to fight his head off for a couple of years to get this much into English. The editors always wanted to chop it down. It is a magnificent volume, not only about Bonhoeffer, but about all of those terrible years of the Nazi regime in Germany, and what led into it, and what came out of it. And it's beautifully written with nice transitions. You rarely go a full page without a break and a new heading. He says what he's going to say, he says it, he says what he said. There's nice summaries. It's big and a little foreboding, but it reads beautifully, and I think that if you're the kind of person who likes to read biography, you would really like that book. Dietrich Bonhoeffer by Eberhard Baitke. There is also a kind of biography by Mary Beausang Kay entitled The Life and Death of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and that's a kind of a Reader's Digest version of Baitke. She has her own point of view, which is a little different from Baitke's, but that's a book of like 250 pages, and you can turn those rather rapidly and get some idea of who the man was. There's also a biography and paper by Kunz in pursuit of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He happens to be a Roman Catholic, and it has a nice little introduction by Baitke. It's a good little book. So these three are possibilities for his life. And that's particularly important for Bonhoeffer because, number one, he is one of the rare people around who did what he said and who said what he did. That's a relatively rare bird. And so when you find out who the man was, you find out something about his theology and vice versa. So for that reason, the biography is important. The other thing is that so much of the literature is fragmentary and unfinished. And in order to understand it, it's really helpful to be able to plug it in to various places in his life. So the biography, I think, is of some importance. There is also this book, The Steps of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a pictorial album, and that's pictures and diagrams and maps and stuff, and that's in the library, and you can learn something in 10 minutes from paging through that, The Steps of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I'm going to say something about the interpretation of Bonhoeffer. Carol suggested the title that's on the board, Who's Bonhoeffer, WHO' or WHOSE? That suggests that there are lots of people who claim him. I've already indicated that in terms of his reception in the United States and in Europe. There are lots of different ways of talking about him. I think that one can boil them down to a couple of central questions. And one is the question of continuity or development. That is, there are those people who write about Bonhoeffer who see in him a basic continuity from beginning to end, who say that in his very earliest writings, in his very earliest commitments, he says and does essentially the same thing that he does later on in life. So that these people would say that phrases like non-religious interpretation of Christianity are a very logical consequence. They have continuity with the things that he said about the Sermon on the Mount and cost of discipleship and about life together in that book. That he's essentially one man, and that his attempt, his involvement in the assassination attempt on Hitler's life was not inconsistent with, but consistent with, the things that he did very early in the game, like talking about the Bible and praying and preaching and all of those things. So there are those who would say essential continuity. On the other hand, there are those who say no, the late Bonhoeffer is a totally different person from the early Bonhoeffer. And there are people who would say that a radical change comes into his life in about 1943 or so, when he decides not only to involve himself in the resistance and the possible assassination of Hitler, but when he abandons the specifically Christian content of his faith. And so William Hamilton, for instance, who's a friend of John Cooper's, and he can tell you more about him than I can. I don't know Hamilton personally. There's one of the people, along with Thomas Altizer, who cooked up the short-lived so-called Death of God movement a few years ago. And Hamilton used Bonhoeffer, I think very incorrectly, to support his so-called Death of God movement. So Hamilton said that when Bonhoeffer talks about non-religious Christianity, he's talking about non-God Christianity. Equals brotherly love, etc., minus prayer, worship, Bible, Jesus, and all that kind of stuff. So Hamilton is one who would say, forget life together, forget cost of discipleship, forget those early days at Finkenwalde. They were the early, immature Bonhoeffer. He finally came to the point where he saw he had to abandon all that junk in order to live as a fully human man in this world and to do that which was necessary, namely to resist the Nazi movement. I think I disagree with that very much. On the other side of the political barrier between East and West, there's a fellow by the name of Hanfred Müller, M-U-E-L-L-E-R, who has written a book entitled Dietrich Bonhoeffer, From the Church to the World. And Müller is a Marxist, he's also a Christian, who teaches at the university in East Berlin, Humboldt University. And Müller says that Bonhoeffer began as a bourgeois, conservative, theologically and politically German, who moved toward Marxism, and who, if he had lived, would have embraced Marxism and abandoned Christianity. From the church to the world is Müller's interpretation. Müller is still living and working in East Berlin, and he represents that basic kind of way of reading Bonhoeffer. I am on the side of continuity rather than of change. I tend to see Bonhoeffer developing, to be sure, but saying essentially the same things at the end of his life as he did at the beginning of his working period. And I tend to see him in terms of that which he was fighting against. And what he was fighting against is any kind of dualism which separates God from the world. I take the key So the whole Bonhoeffer thing, to be a little section in the ethics entitled Thinking in Terms of Two Spheres, where Bonhoeffer says that since Jesus Christ, there is no God without world, and there's no world without God, Jesus Christ means God and world together. And so everything that he does, including non-religious Christianity, costly grace, and all the rest, the whole bag, I tend to see as various ways in which to fight against that dualism of God and world, which somehow or another has plagued the church throughout the course of Western history. So there's a lots of ways of spelling that out. So that's something about the reception of Bonhoeffer. That's something about some books by and about Bonhoeffer. That's something about the interpretation of Bonhoeffer. Maybe we ought to leave it at that for the moment and see if there are any things that you want to ask or raise or say about him. We have some few minutes that we can talk about him if you'd like. I have no idea, you see, having talked for 45 minutes, I have no idea what's in your heads, whether you know a lot about him and would like to go into some detail, whether you've never heard about him, whether you've decided by this time that you know about as much as you care to know, or what. So that's a kind of a first little plumb line.
I have it all on paper. But of course, since your position appears to be that he believed what he did and did what he believed,